Hi, you are listening to the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. This podcast is for policymakers, governments, researchers, students, businesses, and anyone that is interested in conflict and development issues in Africa. On this podcast, we hear from experts from across Africa and the world. Your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa, will ask the questions you would want answers to. Michael Wangpa has an extensive experience spanning over a decade studying, researching, writing, and consulting on conflict and development issues in Africa.
Hello and welcome to another episode of the Conflict and Development in Africa podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Michael Wangpa. Today I'm joined by Dr. Zakaria Pierre and Dr. Kevin Friday to discuss their recent book, Governance, Grievance, and Violent Extremism in West Africa, From the Caliphate to Great Power Competition. Dr. Pierre is Associate Professor of International Relations and National Security at the University of South Florida. His research focuses on insurgencies, extremist movements, and great power competition. And Professor Kevin Friday is Professor of Government and World Affairs at University of Tampa, and he specializes in African politics. Gentlemen, it's a pleasure to have you join me today, and I look forward to our conversation.
Great to be here.
Raylan, so I was reading this this interesting book, and thank you for getting the publishers to send a copy to me, because I like to have one handy when I'm traveling to read it. So let's talk about the Sahel, because this is where it's become the epicenter of where I think, in my own opinion, it's become the epicenter of the global competition that we're seeing, and where it's become like the playground for the global competition. So why is the Sahel that important? Why has it become such an important or force for violent extremism and global competition? I think we've lost Zakaria, but we'll start off with you, Kevin.
All right. So I'll just tell you in advance, as we kind of wrote this book, Zakaria took the lead on the violent terrorism portion, and I took the lead on the great power competition portion. So this is really more in his wheelhouse. Zach,
I'm back and I can hear. I'm sorry for the audio issue at the start there. So if you could just repeat the question, I'd be happy to give it a crack.
So the question, I think Kevin has managed to. So the question is, why has the Sahel become the epicenter of, has it become the epicenter of, insurgency, violent extremism? I want Zakaria to answer that. And as Kevin has clarified, why has it also become the playground for global competition? I want Kevin to answer that part of the question. So who was, maybe Kevin should go first. Kevin had already started.
Yeah, so if we kind of look at the Sahel and talk about it historically, right? These are relatively weak states. If you look at roads per square kilometer, if you look at the ability of the government to do things like tax and provide schools, provide electricity, these are relatively weak states. And one of the challenges with weak states is they become very, very susceptible to external actors who are interested in gaining power. And the reason for that is because the apparatus of the state, right, is not around. The police force, the military, is not up to kind of protecting its own interest in these communities. The communities are used to acting very much as free actors in many scenarios. They don't depend on the state for education. They don't depend on the state for healthcare. And because of that, they become a really kind of a good opportunity for outside actors to intervene. And I think, Zach, did you want to
Yeah, I was going to ask Zach, before you come to one of the things I'm going to come back to Kevin to talk about these Eastern actors. But one interesting thing in the book, like you showed that Eastern actors have always played a role. And you were chatting in the book from colonial times. So do you want to jump on that Eastern actor event from that time and then I'll come back to the contemporary global actors, which we call to a scramble for Africa. So could you pull up on what Kevin has said?
Well, the historical aspect of the research is really quite interesting. And the focus there is on the pre-colonial period, the colonial period, and the post-colonial period, right? And mm-hmm. So what we say is that at least for jihadist groups, and at least in their rhetoric, mm-hmm. they look back to the period that existed before colonialism came about in the region. Mm-hmm. And they look at the systems of governance that were in place in the region at that time. And they start especially with Usman Danfodio in the early 1800s, especially in the north of Nigeria where the Hausa states were. And Usman Danfodio was a religious scholar. And he basically argued that the systems of governance in place at the time were inappropriate, that the rulers were failing to implement Islam, that there was corruption, that there was nepotism, that there was a failure in the justice system, that there was rampant immorality, and that there was a spiral of decay in society. And Danfodio urged the rulers to change, but they didn't really listen to him. And so he initiated a jihad which toppled the house states and in their place implemented the Sokoto Caliphate, which ruled through Sharia law for about 100 years until the British got there. At a roughly similar period of time, you had Shehu Amadou in Mali, who initiated a similar jihad as well, and that implemented the Messina Empire there. And he had similar arguments. And so basically what many of the jihadist leaders, at least towards the start of the insurgency or the insurgencies in the region, argued was that the conditions that exist today mirror the conditions that existed prior to the jihads of the 1800s, right? And that we have the same systemic factors in place today: corruption, nepotism, failure to implement Islamic rule, failure of justice, a decaying of societies. And so they argued that the best example for governance today isn't something new or wildly different. It is a return to authentic forms of Islamic governance that existed in the pre-colonial period. They saw that as a golden age for the region. They saw it as a period of time that was unparalleled in history, almost akin to the period that existed in the first four generations after the Prophet Muhammad. And so really, that's how they have used history. We don't argue that their version of history is necessarily correct. It's often an instrumentalized version of history. They cherry pick things when it's convenient for them. They ignore other factors. They try and neatly package it. But for me, that was really the most interesting aspect of how the historical period has been used or leveraged as a vehicle for mobilization in the contemporary period.
Okay, thank you for that, for providing that historiographical illustration. But I'll come back to you in a moment to talk about the actors. Who are these? Because I know there are several of these actors. But let me go back to Kevin and ask. Now, we've seen in recent times where we've seen populist ideas in the Sahel. We've particularly seen what I call the anti-French sentiments, which is also extended to kind of like anti-West kind of narrative, has led to the suspension of I think MINUSMA in Mali. We saw asking the French and the US to abandon the US base in Agadez and all of that kind of stuff. So How do you explain all of these external factors in terms of externalizing those conditions that Zachary was talking about that the jihadis capitalize on? So do you think, how strong are these external factors that have motivated these reactions?
Yeah, so Zacharias brought up this term instrumentalization, and I think that's a really useful term to view these external actors as well. I mean, this is a region which, if we talk about great power competition, goes back thousands of years. You know, you talk about the great Sahelian empires of Ghana, Mali, and Songhai. While northern Mali, which is part of our coverage area, would have been a close vassal state of some of these empires. The regions in northern Burkina Faso and southern Burkina Faso and northern Ghana would have been periphery, or they would have been areas where migrants, for instance, when the breakup of the Mali Empire separated, would go to settle. So they're used to this constant negotiation of, how close do I want to be to this great power to take advantage of some of their resources? And how far do I want to be from this great power so that I can take advantage of some of my freedom and my agency? If we extend this through the colonial period, right, these are all hinterland communities that we investigate. So we're not talking about Dakar. We're not talking about Accra. We're talking about northern Ghana, northern Mali, Burkina Faso. So these are folks who are used to that tug and pull of, how close do I want to get into these resources to use them to my advantage, or how far away do I want to get from them to access more of my agency? And I think it's a good idea to understand both the relationship, particularly in the Francophone countries, because in Ghana, I mean, people don't have this resentment for the French. It's a Francophone thing. And Ghanaians don't have this resentment towards the English the same way that the French countries do towards the French. But Burkina, Mali, Niger, I mean, they're looking at the French and saying, okay, what can we get from them? The governments, I should say. What can we get from them in terms of resources? What can we get from them in terms of power? What can we get from them in terms of talking points to our citizens? And then they've got competitors now. Russia is interested in being actively engaged in the area. I think China plays quite a different game. It's much more economics related, but they're in there as well. So I think, yeah, I think it's not all that new to what we've seen in the past. It's just different players as great powers kind of circulate and kind of rise to the fore.
Speaking of the great powers, one of the things I find interesting in the book is the nuance you provide in terms of like, the center, how power is kind of like, how power plays out in terms of the center, the periphery, those in the hinterland, and those in the major cities. And we see that play out as well in terms of current demonstration of jihadis, whether I come to ISWAP or come to Boko Haram, and how governments are kind of like in the center, manage power, and these jihadis kind of manage power in the remote level. So it seems that they're sharing this power. So I wanted to see how that plays out in the book. Was quite interesting. I wanted to speak more on that. How that also translates into what we see right now in terms of so I would look at Mali, for instance, when we saw the jihadis playing on the Tuareg rebellions and had control of northern Mali in 2012. Why the Malian soldiers were at the center. So can you speak on the center periphery trope that runs through the book?
Yeah, I'll start and then hand it off to Zacharias. I think, you know, when you talk about most West African communities or most West African states, you've got a capital which has access to far more resources than areas outside of the capital. In terms of roads, in terms of schools, and I'm not saying that everyone in the capital can afford to take advantage of these resources, but it feels like you're in a kind of functioning state in many of these areas, traffic being the one potential exception. Right, when you move into these hinterland communities, what you start to find is the formal state becomes less and less important. Some other work that I've done looked at northern Ghana and southern Burkina Faso and asked people, who do you go to solve problems? And when you get into these communities, oftentimes the answer for basic things like law and order, social safety net, public works is not the police or the mayor or the government. It's other things. It might be my priest or my imam. It might be my chief. It might be my father. It might be Joe up the road who made some money at working for the police department, right? And because of these things, these areas very much, you know, as states kind of can play this back and forth between getting closer to this external power or fleeing away and getting more freedom, so can these hinterland communities in relation to the metropole or the capital city. Because really there's very little state apparatus in many of these communities. Taxation is levels are quite low. The amount of kind of paved roads in these communities are going to be quite low compared to the population. Schools can be few and far between. And while in countries like Ghana, you've got, I think rural areas are electrified at a rate of about 3/4. In countries like Burkina Faso and Mali, it's well less than half. You know, they can play this cat and mouse game of, do I want to get close to the national government? Or in some ways, do I want to, you know, if you've got a competitor out here, the jihadis, or a foreign power saying, hey, I've got some resources, do you want to get close to them instead? And you'll see that same kind of game go out. And I think part of what our book does is says we should pay attention to these communities, because different communities, while they might be neighbors, play this game quite differently. And I don't think we have developed, you know, we have limited data. We haven't developed a great formula just yet for how this works, but we're saying like, this is where the focus should be. And I think we presented data in a way which is meant to say, let's pay some attention to this, because you'll find communities, even in jihadi areas controlled, which are quite resilient, and the community still more or less functions how the community wants to function. And you find other communities where things have really been turned upside down. You'll start to see internal violence start to increase. You'll start to see leadership struggles. You know, what is it about the way that these communities negotiate these relationships that's different and leads to these different outcomes?
Hmm. Zachary, do you want to expand on that and give a different perspective?
Well, I think it was a comprehensive response. What I will say is that one of the things that is not particularly shocking is that often the further from the capital you go, the less legitimacy there is for the central government. People in the hinterlands often identify with the most local region, and sometimes they have more in common with people across the border than they do with people in the capital cities of their own countries, which may be much, much further away. And that speaks again to the setup of these countries in the post-colonial period, where sometimes boundaries were drawn arbitrarily, where sometimes communities were cut across and intersected in ways that may have not been the most natural way. And, you know, I think states have tried to do their best, but because these real issues do exist, right, where communities are cut across, where sometimes borders don't make sense, where sometimes communities on either side of the border might have more in common with each other than with people in their own capital cities, I think that then sometimes gives leverage to external actors to find ways into accessing conflicts or grievances within those regions.
Yeah, but speaking of those borders, one thing that has always amazed me in Africa is, though we understand that the states and those borders were arbitrarily created, but they've also been defended in a way. Like we've seen very little attempt since post-independent Africa for African states to redraw the map or to do this. But again, we've seen how the jihadists capitalized on that. We've seen the Lake Chad, definitely, where you see how from Niger to Chad or whatever, there seems to just be no boundary. Do you think from the jihadist perspective, because we've been seeing the threat of a spillover from the Sahel into the coastal regions. So we've seen, we've seen that some cell in Benin, in Togo, and all of that, is that stream. Is it within that framework of the jihadists capitalizing on that history, that colonial history, trying to challenge that? Or is it, how do you see that?
I think that's interesting because history of the way in which jihadists view history is also context dependent, right? So you can talk about recreating or carving out territory in northern Nigeria, or you can talk about carving out territory in Mali based on Islamic governance on a model that existed in the past. That's kind of it's a little bit of an easier sell in a way, or easier to package a narrative like that, because it's much more clear historically that something like that did exist. I think with the way that they try to expand into some of the coastal states, it is more problematic contextually in terms of linking the past. And I think that's where you see jihadist groups and insurgencies evolve over time. They become adaptive, instrumental. They see opportunities and go for it. A lot of it becomes fights over resources, over control of populations, over the ability to tax. There is sometimes language about we can provide better governance, we can do this or that, but the further away from their historic centers of power that they go, the less a lot of those narratives work. So I think it's about something else, about power, resources, opportunities. That's my sense.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's been my kind of thinking in my writing, not taking away the historical legitimation of that. But I think it's become all about power now. But I'm going to come to you, Kevin, and talk about. So we understand that we can't rule out the grievance that they capitalize on. It's there. Kevin, you're talking about the poor road network, lack of all of this. So it's there. But why do we capitalize on military response? So we look at starting from 2012, look at the French interventions and also the EU regional interventions. This has always been heavily militarized. So why, when in the book we're talking about governance issues, grievance issues, that these insurgents or jihadists clearly manipulate, why in the response, why are we not addressing this? Why are we choosing militarization, from the external perspective as well?
I think it's a lack of creative thinking. There's a certain toolkit that these governments and international actors have that they've used before to some success, and they continue to go back. There's a lot of money involved. It's a relatively quick fix. These other potential responses, they've also got their drawbacks, right? Let's say you build the roads, let's say you build the schools, they could easily be captured. They could be kind of used against you. So there's no easy ways to kind of extend state power and to legitimize the state. It's a slog of a process, but I think that the military, at least in this particular part of the world, has not been an effective response as of now. Like, I don't think the recent bombings in northern Nigeria are likely to stop the jihadi movements in that area. I don't think that the way that the jihadi movements have encircled Bamako in recent months is a positive sign. And there's lots and lots of military resources being dumped into that. If you talk to folks kind of in those regions, they'll tell you that the terrorists are a huge problem. And also the way the government responds militarily is a huge problem. And you'll find folks, in fact, I think if you take time to talk to folks from the region, many are just as worried about getting their heads broken by the military guys as the jihadis. So I think it's a short-sighted response in many instances, not in all, right? And I'm not a minister of defense, so they have information I don't have. But I do think in a lot of ways it's a let's do something, and that's something we have in our toolkit, quick and easy. But it's not necessarily the most effective response.
Yeah, I agree with you. I'm going to come back to some of those responses and even the strategies of jihad. But Zachary, I was going to ask you. Mm-hmm. So what we see before, let's go to Boko Haram now. Before Boko Haram emerged, before it became violent, we saw the sort of theological debate between these insurgents, so with Mohamed Yusuf, with the scholars in the region. But then again, in the book, you've talked about the different tensions that exist between Islamic scholars and these insurgents or terrorists. Can you speak on that? Because again, people talk, again, when you look at maybe in the Middle East, every stuff used to have a fatwa to back it up or something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, talk about the contradictions and tensions between where you have Islamic scholars that are trying to provide or go against. Yeah,
I think that's a great question, because obviously when we talk about conflict and security in the region, when we talk about jihadists, the jihadists, because they are violent, they're loud, they get their message out, they suck out all of the oxygen, right? Almost all of the attention is completely focused on the mobilization of Islam in violent ways to affect change. And that has not really been the tradition of West Africa, has not been the tradition of Islam in the region. So for centuries, as you know, the Sahel has been shaped by scholarly traditions, Sufi orders, jurists that have emphasized restraint. There's been, you know, a big scholarly tradition in Timbuktu, and other centers in the region that have been rooted in mysticism, traditional forms of Islam, community practice, like integrating traditions, and you know, that is very, very different to the Islam that is practiced and preached by the jihadists that want to strip away all forms of locally mediated traditions. They want to strip away local practices. They want to go back to a very austere form of Islam that is much more abstract and that hasn't really been present in the region. And even if you go back and look at, say, Usman Danfodio or Shehu Amadou, right? Mm. And they're the ones that are used as the ideals, right? The heroes of the jihadists. Mm. They were actually themselves rooted in Sufi tradition. And so, you know, there is a big level of tension there. Sahelian Islam's traditionally prioritized mediation, moral persuasion, coexistence. Jihadists have been much more rigid in their ideology. And so that's been going back and forth, scholarly debates, scholarly challenges, attempts to delegitimize on an Islamic basis, the jihadists. But the jihadists are still ascendant. And I think it's partly because the jihadists are able to adapt a lot of times. It depends on the group, right? So Islamic State in the Sahel is much more ideological. They stick to their principles. They're unwilling to bend or negotiate in any way, whereas JNIM, on the other hand, has proven to be much more adaptable, much more instrumental, much more willing to negotiate around ideas and ideals.
I was actually going to go to Kemi, but I'm glad you mentioned that, because I was going to ask you to speak on the different actors and the differences, because we have Boko Haram, we have ICE Jazz, we have ISWAP, and sometimes they cooperate. Sometimes JNM, JNIM, and Islamic State in Great Sahara has also cooperated. So can you speak on those different nuances, what makes them different, and where they might have parallels as well?
Well, it's true that at least in the past, JNIM and IS Sahel may have cooperated. I think that's less the case now. So I think both JNIM and IS Sahel province, both of them seek to carve out territory in the region where they want to implement a strict form of Sharia law. Both of them do not see the existing states of the region as being valid constructs. They both see them as colonial constructs with illegitimate borders. They both seek to violently overthrow those states, and both of them see the ideal as being ushering in a period of new rule based on Islamic law. That's what they have in common, but their approach to getting there is really quite different. And the main difference is that JNIM tends to be much more pragmatic in its approach. It's often willing to work with local communities. In the past, it was even willing to enter into negotiations with the Malian government. Those negotiations didn't really go anywhere, but at least in rhetoric, in principle, they were willing to enter negotiations, which they argued had Islamic precedents based on the negotiations between the Taliban and the US in Afghanistan, right? Mm-hmm. So that was their rationale for entering into those. JNIM also tends to be much better at setting up informal governance structures in local regions. It's like, if you don't bother us, we will provide security for your village. You can pay tax towards us, and so, you know, like, they do more stuff like that, whereas Islamic State provinces, especially in the Sahel, just tend to be much more ideologically driven, much more violent, much more indiscriminate in their violence. Whereas I think JNIM is also brutal and violent, but tends to be more targeted in its violence.
Okay, that's interesting. Now, Kevin, if we come back to the great power competition, and not even just great powers, we've seen in this recent geopolitical competition, we've seen middle powers as well. We've seen Turkey, we've seen UAE, we've seen Iran, and all of that. So if we look at, there seems to be a competition for, let's say Russia, for instance, now, and the AES states, and talk about, it looks more like regime protection or whatever it is for resources. Everybody seems to be vying for resources in that. So if I look at that and look at them within Trump's strategy, and so Trump has that kind of transaction, that kind of approach it in, and put that within the what I term a vibe for New World Order. There seems to be a New World Order. How does this all play out?
Yeah, I think there's two things that these international actors are looking for. Generally, two things. Whether they be great power or middle power, and one is they're looking for friends, right? We want allies. We want chess pieces that if we need them to move, that we can kind of convince them to move. And then the other one is natural resources. The particular areas we looked at, gold is the big one, but I mean, there's it varies by region. I think if you look at a country like Iran, it's very likely looking for, we want a couple of friends. You know, we're largely viewed as a pariah state internationally, or at least they had been in the West. And you know, we'd like more allies. I think to some extent Russia does that as well, but Russia's notorious for using natural resources to fund their mercenary operations. in protection of the regime. I think Central African Republic is the best case of that, or the best documented case of that. But and there's signs to suggest that this is very likely going on in Mali, for instance, where it's most pronounced. I think the U.S. wants similar things. China wants similar things. They do have slightly different strategies. The U.S. is I think, very, at least at this point, it seems like they're very, very interested largely in stemming the flow of migration and also opening up markets for their goods. You know, that might change. That was not, for instance, those weren't necessarily the focal points of previous regimes. I think China wants new markets for its goods and also access to resources. But they're negotiating in these atmospheres with against each other. So if you look at, for instance, the states of the Sahel, Niger, Chad, Mali, Burkina Faso, which have taken a hard turn in the direction of Russia, I'm sure the U.S. and I'm sure China would like access to those resources. They've likely deemed access to those resources not worth the price currently that the Russians are paying. It's I view this very much as an instrumentalist game, and I wouldn't at all be surprised if at some point a regime which has been very pro one side switches. You saw this during the Cold War. You know, Ethiopia and Somalia switched in the night, one to the U.S. and one towards the Soviets. I would not view any of this as these kind of sincere, long-held kind of ties. These aren't inherent friends. These are friends of convenience.
Yeah. I agree with you. I'm glad you mentioned that. I was going to ask, because one of the good things about the book as well, you guys were getting populist views. You were getting them looking at how the common people view this stuff. So if we look at this, like rightly mentioned during the Cold War, African governments had, or regimes, they had leave of power. They leveraged these competing powers to that agency, but that doesn't necessarily bring benefit to the people. But talking about the people, how does the African people? Before I come to the last question, how does this benefit them, or how do they? Because again, they're warming up to these military regimes, which, in my opinion, looking at history, the military in Africa has never brought prosperity to them. They're not any different from the corrupt politicians. So looking at that, again, looking at the population and it being young population, we've seen protests in Kenya and Madagascar and all of this stuff. In Madagascar, for instance, the military took over and then again, you see people burning or raising Russian flags. But this doesn't necessarily bring prosperity to them. So how does the people, or how do they view themselves in all of these dynamics, and how that's going to influence them positively in your research?
So I would say we actually got pretty, in terms of how people view different countries and different regimes, we got pretty, I think, nuanced results. And I would say if you're looking at how the general public views this thing, there's going to be as many members of the general public, there's going to be that many opinions. But I would say in general, you're going to have two responses. One is going to be the made for TV response, right? So when the cameras come out, the flags come out, we're going to ingratiate ourselves to the current regime because they like this power, or they like that power. I don't know how sincerely held any of that is. Maybe it is, but I would say that's probably a very small majority of the population. I think most of the population is largely cynical. You know, the old saying, when the elephants fight, it's the grass that gets trampled. I think people know they're the grass, right? And I think, you know, the communities that we interviewed, what they want is the same thing everybody wants. They want security. They want some prosperity. They want a better life for their kids. And I don't think anybody sees this, for instance, the Russians or the US or the Chinese or the jihadis, as a panacea to all these things. What they see is, I'm in a pretty terrible position in relation to what I'd like to be in. Let's roll the dice on this one because the last one didn't work. And what that means is, if we look in terms of sustainability, that means that there are lots of openings to kind of change the status quo as we currently face it. I don't look at the powers that be in the region as inevitable in any sense of the word. I see kind of there are lots of opportunity for transitions, and whether they'll be better or worse, you know, I mean, it's hard to predict.
Let me ask this final. Okay, go on. You were going to say something. Go on.
I was going to say, you know, one of the most interesting findings that came out of the research for me was that we asked people what types of governance they might prefer, and whether they would prefer more of one thing. Would you prefer more governance based on Islam or based on your religion, or would you prefer more governance based on local elites, or, you know, a range of things? And what emerged was that the most popular opinion was that people thought that the laws on the books that they had were good. They just wanted what they had, but they wanted it to be implemented, right? It's not that the laws that were in place were bad. It's just that no one was implementing it. No one was abiding by the laws. So I think people recognize that, like you said, towards the beginning, it's not that people are against democracy. They just want people to manage it effectively. And at the moment, no, very few instances of effective management.
Yeah, I agree with you. And that's what's coming up from my research. People don't care how they get into power. They just want better life. They just want, you know, they just want to see this, whether it be on the jihadis, whether it be on the, I think that's how people have been pushed into. That's what people just want, a good life. But let me ask this last question. How do you, I'll give each one of you, you know, to answer this. How do you see this playing out? And how should you respond to this jihadist threat?
Well, I think the situation at the moment is really quite concerning. Bamako is encircled. Universities, I think, are now shut. Government offices are ceasing to operate. Non-essential diplomatic staff have been removed from the country. We've also had the largest geopolitical shifts in the regional balance of power, right, with the effective withdrawal of France completely militarily from the region, Wagner Group, Africa Corps, Russia came in, but it doesn't seem that they've done an effective job because the capital is encircled, right? So I think the next weeks and months are going to be very critical. But I think, you know, the key takeaways for me from our research is that security responses have to stop producing the problem that they're trying to solve, right? So indiscriminate counterterrorism, mass arrest, collective punishment, etc., are not really effective. They're driving the population, as Kevin said, between a rock and a hard place, right? So you've got the brutalism of the jihadists often married to the brutalism of counterterrorism responses. The second thing I'd say is that the real battlefield is governance. It's not ideology when it comes to the jihadists. They gain traction where states fail to provide justice, security, and basic dispute resolution. I think that's really, it's important not to lose sight of that. And then thirdly, for me, I think, and this really comes out of our research, is that local actors, not external ones, are the ones that have to be used for legitimacy building and governance building in the region. So religious scholars, customary authorities, community leaders, they already challenge jihadist narratives effectively. But they're often sidelined or intimidated both by states and extremists. And so protecting and empowering these figures, looking at those communities that have been most effective in their resilience, in good governance, and looking to bolster and use our resources effectively at the level that makes the biggest difference to people's lives rather than just sending it to the national government. I think those things might make the most difference. But I also do think the situation is quite dire at the moment.
Kevin?
I think Zach kind of put it really, really well. There are lots of local actors and governance providers who are doing really great work in terrible, terrible situations. We should find ways to remove obstacles from them and instead of putting obstacles in their way.
I agree with you. Thank you very much, gentlemen. And
thank you.
I agree 100% with your views. And I was speaking to Kevin before you joined them, the book that I was writing. And the fun end of this is what's coming to play in terms of how they're reviving, how we should revive traditional leaders, which you term like community religious scholars and all of these people, the role they play, and also decentralizing power. I think it's very, very important in addressing these issues. But anyways, gentlemen, thank you very much for your time. Really appreciate this and congratulations for this. So it's a well-written book. Yeah. Cheers.
Thank you.
Well, thank you for tuning in today. And as usual, Happy New Year. It's a new year. This is our first episode in the year. Join me to thank our guest, my friend, Dr. Zachary Cherry and Professor Kevin Friday for their very rich commentary on the issues in this governance, grievance, and violence. So, if not, check out their new book. It's titled Governance, Grievance, and Violent Extremism in West Africa, from the Caliphate to Great Power Competition. For now, stay blessed, and I'll see you next week.